I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show Book Club podcast, brought to you by Goldster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Magazine Show. I'm really pleased today to welcome Liz Jensen, who is here to talk about her absolutely beautiful new book, Your Wild and Precious Life. Welcome, Liz. It's great to have you on Goldster.
Thank you for having me.
So this is very different from your other books. And tell us, first of all, about your son, Raphael, and how he inspired this very beautiful but very, very sad book.
He was an amazing young man. He was a zoologist. He was a wildlife activist. He was part of Extinction Rebellion. He was very passionate about saving wildlife, protecting wildlife and their habitats. And he was a very unusual boy. He was quite eccentric and funny and always knew what he wanted, a very clear vision of what he wanted. And he and his brother grew up in London. And then he did quite a lot of traveling, mostly working on wildlife preservation projects all around the world. And at the time he died, he was 25 when he died, he'd just started a course in South Africa because he was making a film about poachers, and he wanted to get in shape and do the same training the anti-poaching teams did so that he could follow them to make this film. And then he collapsed out of the blue. He was very fit. And he was on a run with a group of others, and he collapsed, and then he died. And it turned out that he had an undiagnosed heart defect, which is actually more common than you think. And it especially affects young people who are quite sporty.
Right.
It's called athlete's heart.
Wow. And this just, I cannot imagine how that rocked your world. And your response, part of your response to that was writing this book. I was interested by the fact that you felt with the very beginning, when you were flying out to basically bring him home, you started writing on the plane. Is that what then began your idea of writing this book, do you think?
No, I don't think I envisaged a book at all for several months. I was writing a letter to him, and I needed to write. That's my go-to thing. I guess it's my therapy. And it was a very, very long journey. It was 27 hours. I started in Texas and ended up in Johannesburg with a stopover. Worst journey of my life, as you can imagine. But I just wanted to write to him. And strangely enough, that letter turned into a letter from him to everyone he'd left behind. It was very strange. It was as if, you know, I was channeling him or he was channeling me. Something strange went on, but it was, you know, the weirdest time. So it wasn't by any means the thought didn't come to me that I would write a book. I'm very private. I would, you know, if you'd asked me before I wrote this book, what's the genre you would be least likely to write in, and I would have said immediately memoir. In fact, I did say it. I remember people asking me, I'd say memoir. I'd never write about me. And then this book is, you know, very much my story. So it came to me probably after a few months when I'd done lots of writing. I didn't sit at a computer to write. I wasn't in a fit state to even sit on a chair and write. I lay on the sofa and I typed on notes into my phone. Just, you know, a few lines every day or sometimes a big torrent of words. And then after a while, I thought, I've got a lot of notes here. I'll send them to myself and I'll put them in a document. And, you know, this document got bigger and bigger and bigger. It was about 400 pages at one point and had no thread to it at all. And it was very self-pitying, and it would not have been in any way publishable in that form. But there came a point when I thought, well, actually, I'm learning things as I go along. I'm discovering about grief. I'm discovering about, you know, ideas about consciousness. I was doing a lot of reading. That's my other go-to form of therapy. And it was a great big journey of discovery. And I realized that I was not the same person at the end of that first year than I had been at the beginning, and in ways that I thought could be quite useful to help other people who are going through any kind of grief. I don't just mean, you know, the loss of a loved one, but, you know, the change of a way of life. It could be a divorce, or it could simply be a great big uprooting of some kind.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because there are so many different types of grief. And I think this book, it's a highly recommended. It's an absolutely beautiful book. And I agree that it would be very helpful for anybody in many stages, as you say, of flux or change or sadness for whatever reason. But I don't want to give the impression that it's only a sad book. I mean, I cried a lot reading it, but it's also very easy to read. I mean, I just kept reading it. And it's a really interesting book because of, you know, Rath's work as well. And the fascinating things that, you know, the kind of wildlife work that you talk about in the book. Do you want to give us a short reading from the book so people can have some idea about it?
Yes, I'll read you a little bit from the very beginning, from the prologue. Every parent fears losing a child, but when my first son was born, I was gripped with an unshakable terror that it would happen to me. Dismissing it wasn't an option. Its hold was too firm. It made me feel lonely and furtive and ashamed, the way awful secrets do. I couldn't tell anybody, because if I said it aloud, it might come true. But finally, when I became pregnant for the second time, I cracked. "I'm going to lose a child," I told the therapist. "I don't know which one, but one of them will die." He took my distress seriously. "My fear was symptomatic of magical thinking," he said, "the form of superstition that convinces you of non-existent realities or connections. But that didn't make ignoring it an option. Instead, I had to examine where it came from and take active steps to dissolve its power. So after investigating it over several weeks, I went on a small pilgrimage to make peace with something in my past. Placebo or not, the intervention worked. The curse, whether real or imaginary, was lifted. My second son was born, and as he and his brother grew up, the old terror, irrational fears of a young mother, 1989 to 1994, lay half forgotten in the mental equivalent of the kitchen drawer, along with pencils, used batteries, and padlock keys. And then the phone call came. My younger son, Raphael, had collapsed and died. It was inexplicable. He was 25. In that moment, everything else collapsed and died too. My life, my world, my sense of meaning, and time itself. And I'll read another short part from that prologue. "I am not the same person I was before. After trauma, no one is. We hear about post-traumatic stress, but we hear less about post-traumatic growth, post-traumatic regeneration, and post-traumatic spiritual awakening. Yet I have felt all these things in my mind and in my blood, and I inhabit my skin differently. I am less an I and more a we. This doesn't make me feel small. Instead, it frames me as a cell that pulses within the living body of another vast organism that is vital to my own survival and the survival of all that it contains. My son's death will never make sense to me, but it has taught me that it's possible to find other kinds of meaning collectively and individually in the loss of what we love, and in finding them, transform. Resilience is a seed that we all bear inside us. It germinates in emergencies. It sprouts whether we ask it to or not. It sets down roots in astonishing and unexpected ways. And if we notice it and tend to it, it blooms. I have seen it among others who are bereaved. We're sadder than we were, but we cherish life more because of all we owe it. We have learned that if we love the world again, it will love us back."
That's really powerful, really beautiful. Thank you for reading that. How does it feel when you read this book? Is it different from reading from one of your novels, for example?
Totally different, yes, because it's real. It really happened. And there's a huge difference, because when you're reading from a work of fiction. You made it all up. You know, there's nothing, you know, personally at stake in it in the way there is here. I mean, the reason I said I would never write a memoir before is, you know, you're putting your soul on the line in a way that you're not really with a novel. You're maybe putting your reputation on the line or something else, but it's not you. So, yeah, it feels more personal. Interestingly, and I think this is very, very psychological, I was supposed to read the audiobook myself. And 4 days before I was due to record it here in Copenhagen, I lost my voice. It just went and I couldn't get it back. And I had to tell my publisher I can't do it. And they got someone else at very short notice who did a great job. But I thought, yeah, that's psychological.
Yes.
You know, it's not a coincidence that not somehow I was unable to read the whole book aloud.
Maybe you just couldn't speak at that time. It's just too painful.
Yes, it was not. It was, when was it? It was at the beginning of this year. So it had been almost 4 years since he died. So I felt I was ready to do it, which is why I said I would do it. But in the end, my body knew otherwise.
Well, you talk about what trauma can do to the body. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and how did you feel it manifest itself, perhaps with you and your family? That kind of physical repercussions of the death of a loved one.
Yes, it was, I mean, it's a body blow. And we were lucky enough when we were in South Africa to meet a woman who came along to help us, basically. She ran a victim support group and most of the people she dealt with had family members murdered or died in terrible accidents and that sort of thing. She herself had her brother had been murdered, and so she was on a mission to help anyone who was in the kind of position she had once been in herself. And people like that are gold. They are magic. Because one of the first things she said to us was to say, you're in shock and you have suffered a trauma and these are the symptoms. And then she ran through the symptoms, things like, you know, the main symptom for me was not being able to stay in one place. And my other son had it too. He and I, we kept moving around. We'd be in one room, then we'd go to another room and come back in, or we'd go outside and come back in. We just couldn't stay in one place. And she said, that's because you don't want to be in your own skin. And I recognized that. That was exactly what it was. I didn't want to be me. I wanted to be anyone but me. And it was as if I could walk out of my body by moving somewhere else. But, you know, we had, you know, terrible cognitive failures. You know, we kept losing things. You know, our bags, our keys, our, you know, all sorts of things, mislaying things. Not knowing what time it was, not knowing what day it was, being in, you know, you are in this strange, strange world, which feels like a kind of other world altogether. It's like you've burst into some place where you really don't want to be and there's no escaping from it. You can't get out. So that was really important to know. And I'm so glad we had someone to tell us that this was normal, because we all felt like we were going mad. And that it was some terrible nightmare that, you know, we'd wake up from. And of course, we weren't going to wake up from it. It was happening. It was real.
Mm-hmm. So tell us more about Raphael's work, because he was a really extraordinary young man, wasn't he? Tell us about some of the things that he studied and the things that he loved.
Well, he started off as a child. I think the thing that interested him most was insects, actually. He started very small. You know, he ended up with sort of big cats and turtles and all sorts of other creatures. But he started very small. And he, you know, when we went somewhere where there were animals, it was the little ones that he was fascinated by. And he kept fish when he was a child. Got him a little aquarium when he was five. And then later on, he had a couple of lizards. I can't remember what kind of lizards they are now. But they lived in a vivarium. He had a cat, which he adored. And he just gravitated towards animals. Although, you know, he was very interested in the physical, you know, in the body. So we actually thought maybe he'll be a doctor. His dad's a doctor. And he seemed headed in that direction. But then a friend of ours in Copenhagen very kindly showed him around hospital because he was, you know, running part of it. And Raf came back, said, "No, I didn't feel it." And I said, "Is it because you actually rather work outdoors?" And he said, "Yes, that's why. That's exactly why." Because he was, both my children were very much outdoor children, you know, who loved being in nature and mucking around with, you know, frogs in the pond and fishing and all those outdoor activities. So I think that's what made him realize it had to be zoology. And he went to Manchester University because the zoology course there is particularly good. And he absolutely loved it. And he made lifelong friends there. And that was where he set up his organization called The Wild Work, which is for anyone working with animals around the world in sanctuaries and things like that. So it's a kind of wildlife workers' union. And it's going to this day, I think it's got about 20,000 members. And he started that when he was, I don't know, 18, 19.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, he fitted an extraordinary amount into a very short life, didn't he?
He did. He really did. Yeah.
You always had that feeling that one, as you said in your reading, one of your children was going to die. What really struck me was the dream that he had when he was, what, 6 or 7 or something? Do you want to tell us?
Yes. Well, I can read you that passage if you like. It's very short. So he's small, no older than 7. I'm at the kitchen cooking porridge or maybe scrambling eggs, something mummy-ish, I like to think, though the truth is I can't remember. But I remember that it's sunny outside and the windows open and the jasmine is blooming and the scent is wafting in. He appears before me barefoot in his stripy blue pyjamas. His defalled look is serious. He says, "I had a dream." His voice is deeper than most children's, which gives everything he says a comical gravitas. What happened in it? "I had a disease and I was going to die. I stop whatever I'm doing. A cold ribbon of terror slides down my spine. "Were you frightened?" I ask. "No, but I had to tell you and Papa I was going to die. And when I did, you both went crazy. I said it was okay. I didn't mind dying. I wasn't scared or anything. But you kept crying and crying. I tried to make you stop, but I couldn't. I couldn't make you understand." Tears well in his astonishingly blue eyes. The dream has upset him, but the upsetting part is not his own death. It's his inability to stop our pain. This is not the kind of dream that a mother who has already intuited a tragedy can forget. But it's the kind of dream she can suppress. And she knows how to suppress the unthinkable because she has done it before.
Incredible, isn't it? That and had you always remembered that dream or did it come back to you?
And I always remembered it. Yeah. It was, I felt, I mean, I suppressed it, but I never let go of it. It was, I suppose, a nudge to me to be alert. But I wasn't alert enough. This, the thing he died of, you know, he could have died so many other ways. He lived a very dangerous life. He did a lot of parkour. He was always throwing himself off bridges into the Thames and, you know, jumping over things he should never, chasms he shouldn't have jumped off. And, you know, parkour is a dangerous sport. And then, you know, he was in jungles. He got very ill. He had dengue fever once. He ended up in hospital in Thailand, you know, extremely ill. And he worked with venomous snakes. You know, there came a point I realized I can't keep worrying about him. I mean, he urged me not to worry about him. And he said, "You'll go mad. If you think every time I do something I love doing and I'm deep in a jungle and I'm enjoying myself and I don't want to think about you worrying about me." So I was pretty good about that. I just thought, no, worrying about Raf is off the table. I will cross that bridge when I come to it. And then one day there it was. And it was something I could not have dreamed of.
Yeah. And extraordinary, as you say, with all the, you know, all the times he'd been in dangerous situations and there was something that nobody could have done anything about. But,
yeah, you know, yes. And I mean, I suppose, I don't know if I should talk about luck, but in a way it was lucky it happened when he was in a group of people and they all saw what happened, because it could easily have happened when he was scuba diving or free diving. And then it would have been classified as a drowning, because a lot of these deaths are happening in the water and they're classified as drowning, and they're not really drowning. They're heart failure.
Nobody knows what happened.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and I'm really glad that you had those people in South Africa to help you, you know, because just how horrendous if you'd rushed out there and then you'd just been faced with trying to, you know, to work out what to do yourself. So those are the people, aren't they, who just make you realize, the facilitators, just how much we need, you know, for example, funeral services and things you don't think about until you need them. And when you do, you realize just how vital they are. You talk in the book and when we spoke before about how your feelings of how Raf is very much still with you. Do you want to give us some examples of those?
I had a dream, a very vivid dream about him just 3 nights ago, which has stayed with me ever since, because it was wonderful. We were walking down a sunny street and we were talking about our work in Extinction Rebellion and sort of reminiscing about the early days of Extinction Rebellion and talking about the emails we used to send each other with links in and our WhatsApp messages. And we were talking about how we were somehow telepathic. And it was a very sort of joyful discussion. And then when I woke up, of course I knew it was a dream, but I'm past that stage when I wake up from a dream of him and remember, oh God, he's dead. That's long gone. I'm much more at peace with his death, more at peace than I ever thought I could be. And part of it is because I feel his presence so much. I feel he's just in another place and I can't access him the way I would like to, but every now and then I feel him around. I feel he's with me. And that feeling was very vivid in the first couple of years, but it hasn't gone away. Every now and then, something like that dream, you know, can keep me going for days. And I've felt, you know, very optimistic and lighthearted in the last few days because, yeah, he was there.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think writing the book helped you through that grief process? Was it a part of it?
I think it was very therapeutic, because, you know, there's a wonderful quote that I love from E.M. Forster, who said, "How can I know what I think until I see what I say?" And that's very often my approach to writing. You know, if I don't sort of try to formulate a feeling or an idea into words, I'm not going to capture it. So, and the words have to be written down. You know, I write with more fluency than I speak, as many people do. So yes, it was important in that way. And it was important in making me realize that, yes, there are many stages to grief and how cyclical they can be. And things like anniversaries can be horrible. But I think in the process of talking to other people, and that's also in the book, I talk to other mothers who've lost children or parents who've lost children. And that was a very important thing, to find other people who were further down the road than me and learn from them about how they, you know, what they had done. And the most extraordinary thing was a woman I met who'd lost her son to cancer 15 years before. And she said, "You're not going to believe this now." This was in the first year. She said, "You're not going to believe this now, but actually I look back on it as a very beautiful thing that happened." She said, "I'd do anything that it, you know, for it not to have happened. But I see there was great beauty in it, because I went to a place psychologically and spiritually that I wouldn't have gone before." And I can absolutely understand what she means or meant now. I couldn't then. I just thought, this is weird. This is a very weird thing to say. But now I completely get it.
How amazing that really speaks to you now. We have a question here from Suri. She said, "Did your son write any articles or books about the good work he did? If so, how can I search for them?"
Yeah, he wrote quite a lot of articles, and you can find some of his work on iggyfox.com, which I don't know if I can put that in
about
the
Iggy
chat.
Fox. I can put that in the chat.
Yes, Iggy Fox, I-G-G-Y, Fox, F-O-X.com. And that's his memorial site.
Tell us about the name Iggy Fox, where that came from.
Well, he... Iggy is short for Icarus. And he was very interested in the Greek myths. He loved the Greek myths. And he, when he was, I don't know how old he was, probably in his early 20s, he designed his own tattoo that covered the whole of his upper arm and part of his back. And it was an Icarus wing. And it was so beautiful. It was very good at drawing, among other things. I didn't like all his tattoos, I have to admit, but I really loved that one. And so Icarus was actually going to be the title of the book originally. So, and then Fox, he chose a surname because he loved foxes and he had red hair. He had beautiful long red hair. So that was his kind of name as an activist, but he took it on. I mean, everyone called him Iggy, even at university. I think he wanted to change his name when he first went to university because he had been a child actor when he was young. When he was about 8 or 9, he was in a big movie called Nanny McPhee, he loved it. He was a very good actor. I mean, he chose not to carry on with it because he had, you know, other things he wanted to do, but he didn't like being known as a child actor. He wanted to move away from it, and he knew that if anyone Googled Raphael Coleman, they would find, oh, you're the kid who was in Nanny McPhee, and he really, really didn't want that. So that was his way of owning his new name, his new incarnation as a zoologist, was to change his name.
And I love that you put in the poem about the painting of Icarus falling, as that was, you know, as you were feeling at the airport. Do you want to explain that? You'll explain it much better than I do.
Yes. I had heard the news. I was in Texas at the time. I got to the airport and I was sitting there and looking around and realizing that everybody who was there, they didn't know. They didn't know my son had died. And why should they? There's a beautiful painting in the Musée des Beaux-Arts by Bruegel, and it's Icarus falling. And it's a huge seascape where you see ships and, you know, people going about their work. And then there's a tiny, in one corner, there's this tiny image of Icarus's leg. And he's just shot down into the water, and that's all you see of him. And there's a line where in the poem by W.H. Auden called Au Musée des Beaux-Arts, where he writes about, I can't remember the line exactly, but it's, you know, the ship went on sailing, people went about their business, no one cared. And yeah, I was very aware that, you know, you can all be in one airport terminal, but you have no idea what's going on in the heads of other people, what's happening in their lives. And I think that was one of those instances where I think, you know, how people used to say in the street, cheer up, love, it might never happen, that sort of thing. Those people who say that kind of thing have no idea what's going on. So I think, you know, right from the beginning, I became far more sensitive to what people might be going through, what might be going on behind that sort of blank facade of their faces.
Yes, I remember when a friend of mine died and just kind of being on the tube and walking around London and just thinking perfectly like an automaton and just realizing that absolutely nobody else had any idea. How could they? And how extraordinary everybody's own experience is. And we just don't know what other people are going through. What would you suggest? Because one of the things people often say is, well, how should I respond to somebody when someone dies? What should people say? What could they do if they know someone who's going through something terrible, just as you went through?
Say something. Don't say nothing. Mm-hmm. That's my number one. I mean, I have myself, before Rafi died, I've been guilty of this. I have not said something to someone. I didn't know her very well, but I still knew her. And the next time I met her, it must have been a year after he died, I didn't mention it. And I felt so bad after that. She wrote me a beautiful letter after I lost my son, and I apologized to her. And she was very, very gracious about it. So I guess say something, and don't fret about, oh, is it going to be the wrong thing? It just, I'm so sorry. That's all you need to say, really. And or you don't even need to use words. You can just squeeze their arm and give them a hug. But I think in the immediate aftermath of a death, whether it's a sudden death or not, you can be very practical. And the most useful things I got from friends was a message saying, I'm going to phone you at 11 o'clock. Pick up if you can, and it's fine if you don't. Or I'm coming round to take you for a walk. I'm going to ring your doorbell. If you don't answer, I'll come back another time. So without putting pressure on me to say yes to things, because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to interact much at all. There were very few people I spoke to. And even then at the beginning, I could only have one conversation a day. And then I was worn out. I was completely worn out.
We've got a comment here from Monique. She says, I remember being at Funchal Airport waiting for my flight home after my dad had died. And it just felt surreal to be there with the world carrying on around me.
Yeah. Yes, you feel the world should stop. And actually, and I'm so sorry about your dad, by the way. I mean, it's just brutal. Yeah, you feel the world should stop. And the funny thing was, I mean, I can laugh about it now, but it felt very serious at the time. Raf died on the 6th of February 2020. And we were, I guess, lucky that we got to go to South Africa before it locked down. We got back, and then soon after, certainly in Denmark, everything locked down. And I felt, okay, there's this massive pandemic. The world is coming to an end, and it feels only right because my son has died. It was a very grandiose kind of thought, but it felt very fitting. And I was aware that everyone else was going through something very big too. And I think that helped. I mean, it wasn't fun for anyone, but it really helped that everyone was also somehow taken out of their usual world. And they were inhabiting another place, and they were having to learn to live in a different way. So I felt there was a kind of invisible community out there. And I wasn't alone in my grief. And because tragically, so many people died. So many people were dying. So many other parents were losing children or loved ones in that year.
And Monique says, thank you. My dad died on the 18th of January, 2020, just before lockdown as well. And my mother died on the same day as the Queen. And I remember being so glad that there was public mourning. And when the public mourning ended after the funeral, I just thought, no, this should carry
on.
I didn't know exactly what you mean about that kind of thing, that whole world kind of, you know, joining in with that moment of grief. Really? But let's talk about the parallels between personal grief and the wider grief, the work that Raf was doing, and we're going to get onto Writers Rebel, I hope, as well. And the wider grief about climate and the environment and that kind of world pain. What do you think are those parallels or very great differences?
Well, there's the climate scientist, Steve Running, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on climate. He drew the parallel between the five stages of grief and the five stages of climate grief in a way that I think was very useful. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the Swiss psychologist, she came up with this now famous or rather infamous five stages of grief. And they are, I think they are denial. What are they? Denial, bargaining, anger, depression, and acceptance. And then a sixth one was added later. I'll get on to that. But anyway, Steve Running said, you know, denial, we know all about climate denial and people who just don't want to accept it and just keep pushing it away or minimizing it. So we have that. And then we have anger. And, you know, a lot of people I know in the climate movement feel angry, the sort of anger that comes with frustration that, you know, this is the biggest event that has happened to civilization and is a rolling emergency. And people are just carrying on like it's not happening.
Politicians are carrying on like it's not happening. And
they certainly are.
Watch the news and just think, I admire people so much. A friend's daughter is currently, you know, been imprisoned for activism and a very kind of gentle, mild-mannered person. And I just think, gosh, these are the warriors. You know, why this young woman is in prison, for example, when others aren't, I find it inexplicable. But You know, it's just those. These are the people who, in the future, people will look back on, like the suffragettes, and say, "Well, thank goodness
they will." They will. And I think Raphael was very aware of that. You know, he knew that he and his fellow activists were part of a very noble tradition of resistance. And there comes at some point a tipping point where everyone's on board. Unfortunately, it may be too late with climate and ecology, but that's no reason not to keep going.
No, not at all, because I think sometimes that feeling of helplessness is what stops people. And actually, when someone like Raphael has that kind of passion to do something, it's extremely helpful for everybody. Yeah. What tell us about Writers Rebel and what you feel your role is in the climate change activism movement.
Well, again, that's partly started thanks to Raph, because I was chatting online to a fellow writer, Monique Roffey, and she was saying, "Why, you know, are any other writers out there?" I think she put it out on Twitter, "Any other writers out there, you know, concerned about what's going on?" So I wrote back immediately, say, "Yes, I am." And then a couple of others joined us, and we talked, you know, on WhatsApp here and there. And then over the summer, I was in the UK, and I said to Raph, you know, we want to get a writers group together to do something more than just, you know, writing books and you know, talking to our university students about all this. And he said, "Well, you should be part of XR." And he'd been in it right from the beginning. And he put us on to someone in XR who was also, she was a screenwriter. And then Writers Rebel was born very quickly. And then next thing we knew, we were organising this huge pop-up literary festival in Trafalgar Square, which was then occupied. Raph had been part of closing it down, which was, I'm very proud of to this day. All those military strategy games he played on his computer when he was young, I think that paid off. But anyway, so we had, you know, 40 top writers standing on a soapbox and giving readings at this literary festival, and there were police everywhere, and the audience was sitting on the ground, and they were blocking off the road so that, you know, we had a sort of natural human barrier. It was fantastic. It was really electric. And that was the moment when we were born. And after that, it was, okay, what do we do now? We get a website, we publish, you know, we start publishing blogs from writers who are writing. You know, we've published 300 or 400 amazing blogs over the last 4 years. And so we've been going ever since. And then we've got something else that I set up. I was setting it up when Raph died, actually, called the Rebel Library, and that went on hold after he died. But that's a place where you can, if you're interested in reading anything about ecology, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, adult, children, whatever, we've got all the categories. And you can just go and browse and see what books we recommend or our readers recommend. So that's been quite a journey too.
Talking about writers and inspiration, I love the quotation you chose for your book is from Mary Oliver's poem. Was she particularly important to you? Is she a great inspiration for you?
Yes, because she wrote a lot about grief. I mean, really a lot, having grieved deeply herself. So she's a poet with so much wisdom. And it's funny, I didn't read much poetry. I read a lot when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. And then I sort of went away from poetry. But poetry is what you reach for when you're grieving. You want something that can encapsulate something in a few words, because you know, your energy levels are low. So I've really appreciated some of the poetry I've come across in the process of grieving.
Do you want to tell us very briefly about, because we don't have much time left, sadly, about your novels that you've written?
Oh, them. Yes. They seem such a long time ago. And it is, actually, although I'm writing another one now. I never really wrote in any particular genre. So my first novel was a comedy, which was also a bit sort of science fiction-like. Second one was another comedy about evolution. And then there was one which was a satire about consumerism. And then what was there next? And then there was, a historical novel set in World War II. And then I wrote I can't remember what I wrote. I wrote a psychological thriller, I think, after that, and then a couple of climate thrillers, and then a comedy about two time-travelling cleaning ladies. So, you know, I've been all over the place.
Great name, my beautiful book, and Stolen Time. Such a great
title. It was a bit of a publisher's nightmare, I'm afraid, but, you know, you write what you need to write at the time.
And tell us about The Ninth Life of Louis Drax, because that was turned into a film. What was that like, to have your book turned into a film?
Well, it wasn't turned into a film for about 14 years, actually. And there's often a really, really long time between, you know, you selling the option or the rights and the thing actually happening. So I sort of had given up on it, really. I didn't think it was ever going to happen. And then suddenly it was all on. And I was lucky enough to go out to Vancouver to, you know, go on the set of the film. And I loved it. It was an amazing experience. And, you should never expect the film to be like the book. You know, the film to reinvent the book or interpret it in a way that you hadn't thought of. And that's what the film did. So that was a fantastic experience.
Yeah, how amazing.
Yeah.
Well, what was it like to start? I mean, I know you said you thought you'd never write memoir, but as a writer, just taking the kind of the personal kind of grief out of it, the physical process of writing, life writing, a memoir, as opposed to writing fiction, did you have to change your writing practice? Was it something?
No, it came to me much more easily because I think not just because it was memoir, but because it was a non-fiction book. So right. I knew certain things had to be in it.
Yes.
And the order was easy enough to do because it was over the course of a year. So I did, you know, spring, summer, autumn, winter, that sort of thing. So there are a lot of things in place that wouldn't have been in place had I been writing a novel. But the most important thing was daring to just be myself. Because you can't pretend to be someone else if you're writing a memoir. You know, the eye on the page is pretty much the same as the eye in real life. I mean, maybe condensed a little bit and you know, with a better word choice than you might have if you're just speaking, but it is you. And so, I mean, you don't have to step into, I used to enjoy when I was writing novels or I'm writing one now, where I step into a character and so it's a bit like being an actor. You suddenly, okay, I'm this 30-year-old woman. In this situation, or I'm this 60-year-old man or whatever it is, because I like first person narratives. I'm this 9-year-old boy. I've enjoyed being all those different people, but then being myself, that was, I felt pretty naked.
Mm. Gosh, completely extraordinary after you've been creating fictional worlds to have to get to the rawest part of your own life. Would you write, you said you're writing another novel, which is great news. Would you write more nonfiction, life writing, but not necessarily life writing? Is there other things that inspire you?
No, I don't think I would. I think I would. This is the only book I would write as myself. And there's so much fantastic nonfiction out there by people who are experts in something. And I, you know, unfortunately, the only thing I'm an expert in is me. And I think I've said what I need to say to the world in this book. So I haven't felt the urge to say anything else. And I just enjoy reading other people's wonderful books about, you know, what they've learned and
thank you. It
discovered.
Is a really, really lovely book. And Pauline has made the comment, we clearly should talk about death more often. Thank you, Liz, for talking openly. I'm sorry for your loss, which I think is a very good note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today, Liz. The book is called Your Wild and Precious Life. It's freely available. Please do buy a copy and read it. And I would say give it as a gift to anybody who might be going through something, because I think it would help. Thank you so much, and good luck with the upcoming novel.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Join Goldster today to enrich your health and well-being with over 300 live classes a month, and become part of a supportive community tailored for those over 50.